Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 10th of March. And joining me in this edition is AV Forums Hi-Fi editor Ed Selly from Surround Group. We've got Neil Davidson and our special guest is Ian Morrish from Together for Cinema. So we'll be covering the Hi-Fi Bristol show. We'll get a show report from Ed. And in Home AV, we're also joining forces with Ed again because we're going to talk about subwoofers. Everything you need to know, whether it's music, movies and so on. So that is coming up on the podcast today. Also, just a quick reminder of the new format. So the audio only version, which you're listening to here, is a full length podcast. It's available every second Monday of the month. We also have video shots, which will turn up on our YouTube channel. That's normally on a Monday, but they will be throughout the month. So you can join us there on the main channel. If you are interested in movie streaming, discs and so on, then Screen Time from AV Forums is the YouTube page that you want to subscribe to for that. Also, there is the audio-only version of the Screen Time show from AV Forums. That's the fourth Monday of every month. So remember to subscribe to both of those YouTube channels. That's AV Forums and Screen Time from AV Forums. If you enjoy our content and the podcast, then please do consider telling your friends and posting links on groups and forums and so on, so you can get us over to other like-minded people who maybe don't know about the podcast and are maybe interested in the things that we talk about here. And getting the word out about AV Forums would be really appreciated. So let's move over to Hi-Fi. I'm joined by Hi-Fi editor Ed Selly in this month's Hi-Fi section, and we'll be discussing the 2025 Bristol Sound and Vision Show, or is it just the Bristol Hi-Fi Show now? We'll get to that in a second. That once again took place in Bristol at the Marriott Hotel. Right, so let's get down to it. It's one of those events. I think it's 30-something years now.
Yes.
This show has
too
been
many.
So it's one of those where obviously it's been running for such a long time that there is the possibility of a little bit of fatigue around these shows, where it's the same venue, it's the same thing year on year. So maybe you could give us your thoughts on how things were in general this year in terms of people turning up, in terms of footfall, and more importantly, who was actually there and showing off product? Because one of the criticisms in the past is it's only people or brands that are sold through AudioT who are the show organizer.
Let's be clear. AudioT are the people who organize the show. And for that reason, you know, if you're looking to see certain companies, they aren't going to turn up. It's not the case that every single company there sells through AudioT, but some companies make a considered decision that it's not one that they're going to pursue. It's also important to stress that, you know, certain companies come and go through this. It depends where they are in their product release cycle and what they have doing at the time. So, for example, last year, Henley Audio, they of Project and Whim and Musical Fidelity and other companies, didn't attend the show in any capacity. This year, they did. They didn't take their open plan booth. They took three rooms on one of the upper floors. So, essentially, even though the show is very much in the same place doing the same thing, it evolves constantly. You have different people making use of different spaces in the hotel depending on what their priorities are. So last year, one of the largest suites in the entire building was being used by Lynn to show a fairly cost no object system. This year it was being used by Rel to show an entirely cost no object system. So certain things are absolutely consistent. You will find, I mean, for as long as I've been going, you'll have found Wilson Benesch, who do not sell an AudioT, incidentally, in a particular room at the end of the bar area. And other companies are just as big / superstitious about taking given rooms. But others just move around depending on how much they have to show and what they want to do with it at the time. Bristol is, with the best will in the world, and I do mean this in a positive way, an anomaly. It is, if we're being blunt, as you just said, I mean, it's AudioT, it's a regional trade show. And, you know, judged by that, a regional trade show, it shouldn't be a significant launch event. But for reasons best known to itself, it has been for years and years and years. This year was no exception. We'll cover that in a moment. But what it means is, even if you aren't necessarily planning on purchasing a product this year from AudioT, there can be very compelling reasons to go along to Bristol because it's the first time that you will get eyes on a number of things. Often it's first, well, the nature of the calendar means it's first UK showing for a number of things. But more often than not, there's actually things doing their worldwide release there as well. So it punches above its weight, and it's long punched above its weight. And this can be, you know, you can make the same criticisms you can every single year. I mean, I'm been doing them since 2003. There were people there who had been doing them for longer than that. It is a even judged by the standards of shows in hotels, of which there are fewer than there used to be. The Marriott is an odd hotel, although, Phil, you'll never guess, we were treated to new carpets this year.
Oh.
Yeah. And that, I don't recall them changing. They must have changed since 2003 prior to this point, but I can't for the life of me remember when. So new carpets all round. So that was very exciting. It's still a very strange building. But the more established and experienced show practitioners there can often tease some quite decent results out of those rooms. So all of those things, you know, it's one of those things. It's an acquired taste of a show, but I don't think it's that hard a taste to acquire. In specific reference to 2025, you asked about footfall. Footfall is a game of two halves, in so much as Friday, where the weather was absolutely dreadful, attendance was exceptionally good, especially considering it's a Friday and many people have jobs. Saturday and Sunday were both sunny and saw major rugby matches. And Bristol is perhaps not as keen a rugby part of the world as some parts of the Midlands, but nevertheless, it does have a decent rugby team and there's plenty of people interested in it. So footfall, especially in the afternoons on the Saturday and Sunday, was quite a lot less than it was on the Friday. But thus far, I mean, people I've spoken to seemed reasonably happy with how things went. And one of the facets, other judges of productivity for Bristol, because it's hosted by AudioT, if your product is sold through AudioT, you can sell product through it. People who were selling products seemed quite happy with how it went. So make of that what you will. And it certainly felt relatively congested on the Friday whilst I was trying to do photos and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the plural of anecdote is not data, but I would say Friday was extremely well attended, down on the Saturday and Sunday, but nobody seems to be pressing alarm bells over that.
Okay. Well, one of the issues that seems to come up every year, Ed, and one of the comments seems to come is the rooms and the types of rooms. And,
yeah.
And obviously you have the big spaces, which tend to do well and have the big brands in them. But the smaller rooms, going by my experience, which I haven't been to the show in probably about 12 or 14 years. It's been a long time since I was last there. But I understand it hasn't changed that much. And the rooms can be a little bit difficult to get A, people in, and
yes.
B, sound good.
Yes. No, there's two separate issues with the rooms. The first is if you just stick your head around the door, there is a narrow aperture corridor past the ensuite bathroom of the room, and that tends to have some very strange nodal effects. So if you listen to a room from that point there, almost everything will sound like garbage. The rooms do not take kindly to overdriving. By far and away the most successful rooms at the show were predominantly smaller speakers, but there are other speaker designs which are designed to work in relatively confined spaces. So there's a socking great pair of Tannoys and a socking great pair of Lockwood speakers running at the show, both of which are designed to be relatively close to boundaries and fairly forgiving in that regard. And they were both sounding perfectly decent. It doesn't follow that the speaker has to be small, but it has to be content in a small space. Now, since the show calendar in the UK has changed a bit, so in only a couple of weeks' time, we've got the Audio Deluxe show at Whittlebury Hall. There's a Hi-Fi News show later on in the year. Both of these are in larger spaces. And, you know, if you are a high-end manufacturer and you have a pair of loudspeakers that weigh as much as a small car, that's where you take them. Bristol, where you might be looking to sell product and you've got these rooms that we've been talking about, you shouldn't be taking extremely large, extremely complicated things unless you have, as you say, one of the lower suites. And even then, they're not absolutely outstanding in this regard. Most rooms that I went into not all, but most, were playing to the limitations of the space. I mean, as I say, one of the upsides of doing the same show in the same place for so many years, it's not going to come as a surprise what the rooms do. So people who knew what they were doing were getting more than respectable performance. I mean, just a case in point, one of my favorite sounding rooms, it didn't make it into the show report because there was nothing technically new in there. Graham Audio, the speaker manufacturer, Auralic and Sugden had combined forces for a room, and it wasn't a particularly large pair of loudspeakers, a sort of classic BBC pattern set of stand mounts with an 8-inch driver. It could be driven hard without, you know, running into the limitations of the system, but it then wasn't overloading the room. It just sounded fundamentally right. And it was, you know, there were a number of sort of rooms running at that sort of pattern of equipment, and they were all sounding more than halfway decent. Equally, one or two people, yes, had brought something oversized along and it wasn't quite so happy. So some people are still learning lessons that other people have learned.
Yeah. Right. So let's get into some of the standout products then. You know, what did catch your eye this year? And I believe most of these will be in the show report.
Yes, absolutely. The thing that caught my eye, before we do specific products, was a couple of things. The first is, one, there is a surprising amount of new product out there. Now, obviously, we're dealing with stuff developed prior to the current international fun and games, but there is nevertheless a degree of confidence that things are going to continue in with some degree of success. But the products that debuted at Bristol, for the most part, didn't have telephone number price tags on them. And I found that quite heartening as well. If you aren't shopping with an enormous budget, there's some good stuff coming this year. I mean, in terms of quite a lot of this, Henley Audio, as I say, had skipped last year's show but came back to do this year's one. They focused on affordable stuff. So Henley represents, amongst other brands, Wim, Project, and Musical Fidelity. So each of those companies was issued a room. Wim had their new amp, the name of which escapes me. You'll have to bear with me on this. It's an unusual piece of equipment because it's the first WIM product that has made an appearance that does not have any form of streaming on board. It is designed, the VibeLink amp, sorry, there we go, is designed to complement existing WIM streamers. It's a styling match for the WIM Ultra streamer. And, you know, it, whatever final calculations you make about sonic performance, it costs £320, which is, you know, that's sensible money, let's be honest here. If you want to spend a little bit more than that, Musical Fidelity with the B series, this is a much more classic shaped and sort of styled piece of hi-fi equipment, but nevertheless the integrated amp has got niceties like digital inputs, HDMI ARC, etc. The CD player, interestingly, we've had lots of comments on recent CD reviews that you lot really don't like inhaler drives. The CD for the, excuse me, the CD for the B series is £600, so it's going to be a bit more than some of the CDs that we've looked at, but it has a proper tray type drive, and I know that some people are going to be absolutely delighted by that. Then Project, they debuted, no pun intended, the colourful system from last year. No, not even last year, the year before that. They've updated those, and there's now two of them. So there's a relatively keenly priced one. Oh dear, that's just gone bananas. At £1,099, turntable amp speakers, and the amp's got some digital inputs as well to cover you there. And then a more elaborate successor to the beautiful system that we've already reviewed, which is £1,799. Now, obviously, £1,800 is still a lot of money, but in the scheme of some of the stuff that we've looked at and been sent press releases for recently, this is all very keenly priced. And then it just continued in that vein. Riga have the new Brio due out imminently. Price has crept up on that to £800, but it's built in the UK. It's the first Riga Brio to have digital inputs. It's also the first Riga anything to have standby, which is a big deal for the company. Neat, they were demonstrating speakers at £5,000, £7,000, but they've also got a new version of the IOTA, one of the earliest things I ever reviewed for AV Forums, which will be a whisker over £1,000. And it continues in that vein. Fine Audio have been bolstering their more expensive end of the market. They've gone back to the lower end of it with the F500 series of speakers. Again, not absolute bargain basement, going from about £600 to £1,800, but bespoke, sounded excellent, genuinely impressive engineering. Acoustic Energy were there with new 300s. They range between, I think, £400 and £1,800. And you just got the feeling that, there was that for a long time, that the lower end of the market has been, it's been receiving new products, but they sort of trickle in and they just essentially just keep it ticking over. There's a lot more effort on winning customers for the first time now, because those are the people that you hopefully retain long enough to sell some of them your more expensive and more profitable equipment. I mean, there were obviously more expensive items. There's a new Cyrus Phono stage coming. There's a new Michelle Phono stage coming, which is a new Michelle product, which is genuinely exciting. And the prices start increasing from there. So the Cyrus is 2,200, the Michelle's 3,000. There's a new exposure amp at 5,000. There was a new pair of quad electrostatics at 12,000. It's not all bargain basement, but it was, for the most part, most of the things there was at least a nod towards attainable. And I thought that that was genuinely appealing. The other thing that's quite interesting, before I finish, take a breath. All too often in recent shows, I say recent shows in years gone by, you'd be shown something and it would be very exciting. I'd write about it in the report. It's like, when am I actually going to see a review version of this? Oh, we've got a while yet. We've cobbled this one together and we've got months more development to do. Almost everything that featured in the show report, I'm sure that one of these products will, for reasons unforeseen, be significantly delayed. But almost everything in that show report, I'm supposed to see in the front half of this year. And I do not remember that happening for a very long time. What we're being shown by manufacturers is stuff almost ready to go. We're not being teased with vaporware.
Yeah, no, that is unusual because, like you say, just over the last few years, and obviously since the event, things have taken a little while to come through, and products development and parts and all that kind of thing. So it looks like we're well over that now,
Well,
and
hopefully,
things,
yes.
things are turning up quickly. Any trends that you noticed this year? I mean, obviously we've spoken about the show report there, and obviously that's on the AV Forums website. You can go and look at that and see all the images that Ed's just been talking about there for all the products. But was there any noticeable or obvious trends that you noticed this year, Ed?
Yes, there's two that stand out. The first is, even when something is not a one box system, the nature of how it's being marketed, sold, and supported with other pieces of equipment, manufacturers are really pushing a much greater homogenized, we would like you to buy everything type of approach to making product. If you are a manufacturer of one type of product, that's going to be more interesting for you. I mean, when you see those project systems where everything comes in the box and they're good to go, you get separate style flexibility, but there's no, oh, will this work with this, and so on and so forth. Riga's been pushing that approach with the System One, and obviously, they make complete systems. That Michelle Phono stage turning up, you get the feeling that it's now, if you choose to buy a Michelle turntable, you can buy cartridge arm turntable phono stage, and it's all going to hang together. If you want, the manufacturer can supply it in a sort of pre-built state. And this is going to become, it's going to become one of those things where, yes, you can use this equipment in systems where you've chosen every single component yourself because it's just so, and the dynamic relationship with them is exactly what you need in your space. But the vast majority of people aren't going to do that. This is, we are looking at, and we're looking at, I think, a move towards even systems that are comprised of multiple boxes. Those multiple boxes come from one manufacturer. Within that as well, the other thing that's sort of really becoming apparent is that convenience has won. And I do mean, and I'm very positive about this. You're looking at products where HDMI ARC is routinely fitted and it generally works and it does what it's supposed to do. They are littered with features, which just makes them easier to use day to day. They do the things that you want to do. They're not that you don't have to add extra bits to get certain functionality and so on and so forth. We have a couple of manufacturers will continue to make hay over building exceptionally minimalist product, but everyone else has come to terms with the fact that you can put extra features on something and it doesn't affect how it sounds. And just the end result is more user-friendly, more convenient, more flexible, and more appealing. And I'm very glad that we've learned this lesson, and I'm very glad that we've learned it prior to becoming extinct.
Do you think it's a generational thing? Do you think that there are younger consumers now
Yeah,
coming through and
and they were
demanding that
there.
things?
I'm going to hesitate to describe the people there as young.
Yeah.
I mean, there were people who I would describe as young, but there were still relatively small numbers of those. But the actual age groups of people there, there were fewer out and out old people and people who were more comfortably into early and standard middle age. And yeah, essentially, if you, we've had this conversation across a number of podcasts. If you are coming at this from an AV background, coming at this from a soundbar background, or you're just coming at this from you've used other modern consumer electronics, some of the implacable minimalism of two-channel audio is just going to seem parochial and inexplicable. And a number of manufacturers have gone, do you know what? You're right. And you want to mess about with the tone controls, EQ curves, all the rest of it, you can go nuts. You can do that. You want to connect your television to it? Please do. This is the socket for it. You want AirPlay, Bluetooth, Chromecast? Yep, not a problem. And it doesn't matter that the product is notionally a high-end one. You can fit AirPlay. It doesn't have any effect on the actual baseline performance of the unit. It's got AirPlay. We are in a situation now where you have to really want minimalism for it to be, it's not something that's thrust upon you whether you like it or not. In the time I started this, tone controls were relatively unheard of. And now, to be honest, the market is accepting of the fact they, contrary to what a number of people who comment on reviews might say, at the moment, the public is not demanding Dirac and EQ functionality, but they are comfortable with it being present for them to experiment with if they see fit. If that continues to evolve, that continues to evolve. But we're making progress to people not discounting something because it just does more than the one thing that they were looking for it to do.
And you see that across a lot of products, so not just hi-fi, but it's an interesting point that you made there about Dirac. We're seeing, I've certainly saw it in the last 2 years with TVs, you now set a TV up, and with some manufacturers, it will say audio setup, have the remote control at ear height, press this button, and
Yeah.
it does an auto EQ from your listening position nowadays. This technology is just being used by more and more people. People are getting comfortable with it now. They're now expecting it on a lot of products. So we're not talking about just AV Forum's core hi-fi users here. We're talking about the much wider marketplace where people really are starting to realize this. And it's one thing that hasn't disappeared. And it's interesting hearing what you're saying about footfall at Bristol and so on, is that there is more interest, I would say, now in high quality music and music listening in the home than probably in the last 20 years. And it seems to come in waves, but we seem to be on a wave at the minute where more and more people are, because of the whole lifestyle thing, because of smart speakers and everything else, and you can join speakers up in different rooms and have multi-room systems and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
People then want to listen to things on it, and again we're seeing an uptick in that, and a real change in the demographic, I would say.
Yes, and not before time, fundamentally. And I had my concerns in years gone that there would be an element of struggling to adapt, and there isn't. For the most part, most companies have gone, do you know what? That's what you want. You can have it. And dying on principle doesn't seem to be something that's big in at the moment, and I'm perfectly comfortable with that. So yeah, it was I'd come out of Bristol in different moods depending on what I've seen and who I've spoken to. I came out of this one feeling pretty positive, if I'm honest. I liked the new product that I saw. I liked the people that I saw looking at the new product, and I felt reasonably optimistic. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's very hard to separate, you know, the ongoing, this is not a politics podcast, so I'm just going to say the ongoing international fun and games is going to have, going to affect the industry in the way that it's going to affect everything else. And, you know, we don't know, you can't aim off for that because it's completely unknown. I do get the feeling that most companies have chosen pragmatic paths about getting new people through the door, and I'm hoping that pragmatism is going to be the way forward in this instance. And Bristol showed a degree of optimistic pragmatism, and I like that.
Excellent. So if you went to the Bristol show this weekend and you want to add to the comments below on this video on YouTube, then you can do. Let us know what you saw, what your picks of the show were, and so on. Or if you just like hi-fi shows in general, if you give us feedback, are there enough hi-fi shows in the UK or the US? You know, do you get an opportunity to go to a dealership and listen to this stuff, or do you want to have more of these types of shows where you can go along and listen to what's new and find out new products and so on? Let us know in the comments. You can also do that if you're listening to the podcast version in the podcast thread. Before we wrap up on hi-fi, let's have your recommended album, vinyl, and playlist.
Right, album and vinyl are the same. As veteran listeners of this podcast will know, I am extremely fond of French electronic music. I make no bones about the fact I think they make the best electronic music in the world. Last Friday, a French act called Scratch Massive released their latest album. It's called Nox Anima. It's on all the major streaming services. It is available on vinyl to pre-order. I have pre-ordered it. So this recommendation is unlistened. So, you know, my proviso on that. Nox Anima is just, it's magic. It's one of those albums which sounds pretty good the first time around. Then the more you listen to it, different details come into it. It's brilliantly done. Absolute riot to listen to. It's more akin to slightly older performances from the band. Their album before this was a little bit odd, and they then spent a couple of years doing film soundtracks, which are very good, but they are very much film score rather than sort of something that you necessarily want to spend an enormous amount of time listening to on its own. This is a massive return to form, no pun intended. So it's my recommendation across both. Playlists, Cobuzz, being who they are, tying in with the film people, they've done a playlist of all the best original song Oscar winners for some time, and then best original Oscar score winners as well. So those are worth a bit of time. There's some, if nothing else, then not, it's one of those sets of playlists where it's not necessarily the case that you want to listen to them just sort of a standalone, but as jumping off points to go and then find things that you want to listen to on their own. Yeah, that's what you want to do. So both of those come highly recommended. It wouldn't surprise me, for those of you who are not Cobuzz listeners, if other streaming services have probably mustered something along those lines themselves as well.
Yeah, I think I've seen stuff elsewhere, but my go-to for playlists at the minute is Cobuzz. I'm thoroughly enjoying my subscription.
They are the best at it. So,
I left off for a while thinking, no, do I want to spend another 10 or a month? But actually, it's probably one of the better spends on a monthly basis. So, yeah, thank you very much for your recommendations there, Ed. And Ed's going to come back a little bit later on when we talk about subwoofers. And normally we'd go to TV at this moment in time, but we've actually got a special video for you. So if you're listening to the audio only podcast, we spent some time at Dolby at Soho Square last month in February with LG. It was all behind closed doors and secret squirrel, but it was to look at the new TVs for this year, the new 2025 lineup, which included the G5 OLED. That is their big TV for this year. It features the new four-layer tandem panel, the primary RGB tandem panel. It's still a mouthful, that, which is replacing MLA for this year. So it promises to be much brighter than previous models, but also, and more important, is the colour volume. They are saying that this TV is going to be far more colourful at brighter brightness levels, which has always been an issue for WOLED. Well, I did manage to get a few measurements and so on, and you know, this product will be coming very soon for review. But if you want to see more about that, obviously about the C5 TV, so that is the replacement for C4, obviously, which is the It's the sweet spot in the LG range. We spent some time with James from LG UK looking at the G5, C5, and two QNED or QNED TVs that the company are also introducing. So that's their LCD mini LED lineup as well. So if you want to find out a bit more about all of that, then go and watch the video on our main YouTube channel from LG in Soho, and you'll see all of those details. And like I say, the reviews should be coming up very soon, maybe before the next podcast goes out as well. So no TV section this month, but go watch the video. There's lots to do there. And moving on, we've got a special guest. So in this section of the podcast, we have a special guest. Ian Morris is joining us, and Together for Cinema. You may have heard of the name. You may not know exactly what it stands for and what it is. It's more of an industry thing. And it's certainly, if you're not in the custom install industry, you may not have heard about it. That is one of the slight issues why Ian's on this podcast, because I think the cause deserves a much wider audience, and a lot more people need to know about Together for Cinema and what it's actually about. So welcome, Ian. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Hi, Phil. No, thank you. Thanks for your interest in what we're doing.
So, Ian, before we find out about Together for Cinema, just tell us a little bit about you and your background.
Gosh, 35 years in the industry. My background is non-technical. I'm the least technical man I think I know in the industry, but my background is sales and customer engagement and sort of management, account management. I worked with Cedia for 9 years. I worked at the ISE show building it, well, for 13 years, joined in 2007, left in 2020, building it from the little show it was to the monster it became in Amsterdam. That was a very progressive 13 years. While I was at Integrated Systems Europe, I started Together for Cinema in 2009. So we'll obviously get to that in a second. But that's my background, basically sales and customer engagement, non-technical.
And for those joining us on the video, that means that side of the industry that you're talking about is the custom installation. It's the smart home side of the business. It's not necessarily the consumer facing side. It's more business to business. Is that correct?
Yeah, business to business, mainly in the residential market, obviously with Cedia, but for Integrated Systems Europe, the ISE show, that was a trade show. So as you say, business to business, and as I say, the show has just grown enormously. Anyone in our industry will probably know, well, they certainly will know of that show.
Yeah. So let's talk about Together for Cinema. So first of all, what is it? When did it start? And what's the aim behind it?
What it is, it basically, the simplicity of it is it's an AV industry, good cause, now a community interest company, a registered community interest company that comes on the company's house. That works with the AV industry to install cinema rooms into beneficiary venues like children's hospices and other deserving family care scenario venues, so adult hospices, respite care centers, and so on. It started in 2009 while I was watching TV. I won't bore you with all the emotional details and the drive, but I had an idea in 2009 while I was working at ISC because things were going well there. I thought I'd like to give a little back. So 2009, I watched a program called The Secret Millionaire. 14 months later, our first cinema room opened at a place called Donna's Dream House in Blackpool, which was a holiday home for children with short lives. That was received really well. Not a penny changed hands for the next 12 years. And we installed 25 rooms by 2020. And again, not a penny changed hands. It was all donated installer time, donated expenses by myself and others, and donated product. Had they been paid for, those 25 rooms would have cost probably just over £500,000. And we are now moved forward to 2025. We've installed 51 rooms. Had they been paid for value at 1.4 million. So it's been a real industry supported, backed, loved movement, actually. And I say industry, more the residential AV industry. We're very well known now in the residential world, sort of CDA world. And we have lots of partners who support us with a little bit of money, some product, and some installer time. We can always do with more. But we're very well supported. So it's been a great journey so far. It really has.
And I know it might be an obvious question, but I think it's an important one to ask is that these cinema rooms that you're putting in, how much enjoyment, how much therapy, how much good
Impact.
impact does it have on the people that you're donating these things to?
When I started this, I had no idea, actually. And I just it was almost like personally, I just wanted to do a little bit of good and give a bit back. As each install goes on and the impact and understanding of the difference we're making grows, I can say confidently, without any arrogance, because I set this thing up, it's a huge impact to bring the cinema experience into a beneficiary venue that simply doesn't have that facility to take the children or the family to a normal cinema is huge. It really is. That cuddle time with mum, that losing themselves an hour and a half in a darkened room with twinkly lights on the ceiling and a big picture and the super audio, that's really hard to get to for most of these families and most of these venues. I think it's proven by the amount these rooms get used, not only as a cinema room, but also as an AV interactive room, with gaming, maybe with disco karaoke, with fundraising, with training, and so on. These AV room facilities, cinema rooms, have been really well received. So the impact is huge.
And I guess we're moving in, the whole industry is moving towards more immersive venues, more immersive rooms, more immersive audio, and so on. So it's not, I would imagine, just the cinema side, but it's having a nice, comfortable, quiet place to sit and reflect, but also perhaps have, a bit of immersion, a bit of audio, a bit of light, that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, I think it's sort of it's an extension of, I mean, for example, in Children's Hospice, they have sensory rooms, and this is an extension of their sensory room stimulation. Big picture, fantastic audio, twinkly lights, LED lights, and so on. It really is an extension of that. Talking about the immersive side and the sort of the quiet side, one story we had an installation in the Children's Hospice that had an adult hospice next door. And there was an elderly couple. The gentleman was dying, and him and his wife got wheeled in the cuddle bed, as it's called, and they watched It's a Wonderful Life. He died 2 days later, and the wife said it was just the most calming, almost you can go now sort of moment, while they had that an hour and a half in a darkened room watching It's a Wonderful Life. Stories like that, really do sit very strong with me, and I think most people. Lots of other stories I could tell you, of course.
So, I mean, how does this whole process work then, Ian? Do venues come to you? Do you go to venues? And how do you then put the room together? Is it made specifically for a certain is every room different, or is there a plan that
Absolutely.
you work to?
Yeah, no, every room is very different. But the process is such that we started working with Together for Short Lives, which is a big umbrella charity of children's hospices. And they know us very well. And we now work with Marie Curie Adult Hospices and various other charitable groups, NHS hospitals as well, we're working with. We tend to have people come to us now because the word has got out that there's a free cinema room available. Hey, look, that gets out there and people ring me up. So we have 10 more installations this year. We already next year have six on the books, and in the pipeline, there are lots more. So it used to be me almost selling the idea, and people were very suspicious. This is too good to be true. So it was almost I had to impose it on them. But now we have lots of people coming to us. The way the system works is that we find a venue, I visit the venue, have a look at the rooms. They're all different. They're completely different. Some have hoists in, some have real serious medical considerations. Some are box rooms, some have really high ceilings, some are, they're really challenging. We find an installer locally. From generally a CEDIA member installer, they don't have to be, but that's just a good group that we go to. A CEDIA Trade Association member installer who then visits the venue as well. We discuss what can be done with the room. That's as far as my technical ability goes. And then the installer draws up a product kit list that he feels would be suitable for the room. We then pass it with the venue. We then go and get the equipment. Most of it, if not all of it, is donated. And then the installer installs. We have an opening event. You might get a celeb down or whatever it is. We report it, then we move on to the next one. There's a lot of feel good. There's a lot of not so, yes, of course, for me, but I think for the whole industry, everyone that contributes, people want to be involved because most of our installers install for high net worth individuals who can sometimes be a little arrogant, can sometimes not use their cinema room very often. These rooms, the gratitude is huge, and they get churned. They get used every, certainly every week and probably every day. So there's a real difference to the installers as well.
So as well as Together for Cinema, Ian, I do believe that there is another interest that you have here, and another business, and another way for the industry to give and receive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as inspired by Together for Cinema, having realised the desire for charities and good causes to improve their AV offering, as it were, we've introduced and commissioned a website called givingback.tech, TECH, and very simply, what it is, it's almost like a freebase site where we would ask manufacturers, distributors, integrators, corporates, et cetera, to post individual items that are discontinued, B stock, or secondhand on this website. There'll be a simple way to do this and so on. This website then will go to the charities and the community interest companies in the UK. And it's very simple. They can just select what products they want. Generally, they're sort of more plug and play than sort of complex control. But you know, if there's a screen, there's a projector, there's some speakers, there's a, you know, a video conferencing soundbar, et cetera, that all of these charities could use, that there is millions of pounds worth of equipment, as we all know, sitting in warehouses, gathering dust, doing nothing, you know, and some of it's secondhand, et cetera. So this is just something that the people I've spoken to in the industry, you know, the trade associations, why haven't we done this before? Well, we're doing it. It may be ready in 6 months, it may be 2 years, but we're going to get it right and we're going to do it.
Yeah, like you say, you know, people, once they hear about this and the good that you guys are doing, they want to get involved in some way. Our audience are huge; they're all enthusiasts and so on. If they feel that they want to give a little bit back and so on, how is there some way that they can get involved with Together for Cinema? Is there some way they can donate, or
Absolutely.
yeah? So maybe
Yeah,
tell us about that.
but yeah, by all means, thank you, Phil. I mean, thanks for the prompt for me to appeal. Yes, hey, look, we need as much help as we can get. We're only a relatively small community interest company. We turn over just over 100,000 a year, and that's enough to keep us going. We can do more. We really can. The way that people can get involved, I mean, first we have a website, www.togetherforcinema.co.uk, and the four is letters, FOR, togetherforcinema.co.uk. And you can contact me through there. The other option is to email me at ian@togetherforcinema.co.uk. And then we can just chat. We can chat about how you might want to get involved. People may have some secondhand kit that is in perfect order. They might want to donate it. They might want to make a financial donation. They may know a venue that would be really suitable for us to work with. We need eyes and ears and support from, you know, from the industry and from your listeners.
Yeah. Well, it's been great having you on the podcast, Ian. Thank you very much for your time. I think it's a great cause. I've known about you guys for a little while, and you know, it's always been a desire to get you on the podcast, just to get the word out there that you know, we see all the fancy stuff, we see all the fancy rooms, and like you say, high net worth clients and all the rest of it. We see the fantastic cinemas that they have, but I think these rooms, like you say, have a huge amount of impact, and
Really
for
do.
people who really need it as well. So yeah, great cause. I'm a big fan. And if,
Thank you.
like Ian says, if anybody wants to get involved or find out a little bit more, go visit the website. And if you feel inclined, then get in touch with Ian, and I'm sure you'll appreciate the contact and any ideas or donations or anything else that you guys might want to give. And moving on, I'm joined by Ed Selly, and Neil Davidson from Surround Group is joining me for this month's Home AV section, which is a bit of a crossover because we're talking about home AV, but also hi-fi. We're going to be talking about subwoofers. And we're going to do our best in terms of wrapping up what a subwoofer is, but also what you'd use it for. And is it right that we should be using it for two-channel as well as multi-channel? It's one of these age-old arguments that's been going on. Well, definitely the 20-odd years I've been in the hobby and doing this professionally and so on. You know, subwoofers, how many should you have? Should you have them with two channel and all the rest of it? But I think we need to go to the basics. And to explain our panel, Neil Davidson from Surround Group. Neil's been around a very long time, business to business mainly in terms of custom installation. He builds everything from mega million-pound DCI home cinemas all the way down to, not mega millions of pounds, but still pretty tasty home cinema stuff. Neil's also knows his thing, a thing or two about audio and so on. He has lots of things to measure, lots of audio characteristics and so on. So he's also, I'm going to say expert, Neil, in room acoustics and putting rooms together and making them sound good. And of course, the worst speaker to try and put in any room is a sub bass speaker. So Neil has quite a bit of knowledge there. And also on the podcast is obviously our hi-fi editor, Ed Selly, lives in the world of two channel, and rightly so. It's a fantastic world to live in. Does he have strong opinions and strong views when it comes to subwoofers? We're going to find out all of that in this edition. But first of all, what is a subwoofer, Neil?
Well, subwoofer is a good question. Subwoofer is a speaker that's intended to add some low-end extension into your system. It's really dedicated to the low frequencies, let's say 150 hertz down, although people will always try to play it a little bit lower than that. That's the job of the subwoofer, is to give that low-end emphasis in the system.
So, Ed, why do you think there has been in the past this strong pushback from the hi-fi community when you're talking about subwoofers and sub bass?
Well, there's two reasons. One is vaguely legitimate, and the other one is reactionary, I suppose, with the best will in the world. As was hinted at, actually getting subwoofers to behave themselves in an optimal fashion in room is more involved than can be the case with most other loudspeakers. When you took into account that the toolkit available to two-channel audio in a traditional basis was rather smaller than it was for AV about getting subwoofers to work, a number of people were simply not keen on the idea because, bluntly speaking, the means of actually getting a 2.1 system or 2.2 system to do what it was technically capable of doing in a reliable and enjoyable way was a little bit hit and miss. Now, within this as well, subwoofers, essentially, the place where they've always sold strongly, historically, has been in an AV sense. And as I'm sure we'll cover in a little bit about this, so whilst you can in 2025 you can coax extremely good results out of almost any subwoofer if you throw a little bit of processing at it, if you're looking at this in a more traditionalist sense, some of the design functionality and features that optimize AV performance, where you have a dedicated LFE channel and so on and so forth, do not necessarily transfer to being completely successful when you're not sending it a dedicated signal, when there's an element of handed over crossover, and so on and so forth. They're not insurmountable issues, but it's led to, if you like, a little bit of reluctance. If you've heard enough bad 2.1 systems, you aren't necessarily going to fall over yourself to have your own one of those. And for a long period of time, some of the hardware just simply didn't necessarily play nice with two-channel audio in a way that encouraged you to want to try.
So, Neil, let's get back to home theatre because this is where people know the subwoofer from. You just have to look at probably the last 30 or 40 years when it come to home cinema. You're looking at Prologic days, you're looking at moving into digital audio eventually and then immersive audio and so on. The subwoofer certainly been a speaker that has gone through all of those phases because for home theatre, the easiest way to get five speakers in a room was to make sure that the speakers were small and then have a box that took the lower frequencies and did all that. And the reason why that works is obviously because bass energy is not directional under certain frequencies. So with that in mind, give us a little bit of potted history on the subwoofer in terms of 5.1 and where we are now with 5. Well, you actually add in the height channels as well now. So
28.28.
yeah,
That's what you're looking
it's
for, Phil.
quite a bit. So maybe just give us a quick potted history of the subwoofer before we go into the more interesting bits.
Well, so I mean, you picked it up there. I think that the subwoofer did start off gaining its popularity in the home AV sense, definitely with those 5.1 systems. And I was thinking, what a long time you've said there. But then I remember selling those things back in Currys in the late 90s, and it was agonized. Maybe you saw that on my face when I was thinking about it. That was when that came, and interesting. I wonder how many of us would still welcome a really nice little subsat system, instead of all the sound bars and stuff like that as a good option these days. Now, when you start to move into more channels, naturally, the bigger the speaker, the more challenging the aesthetic integration comes. And that was really the benefit of a subwoofer. It was sold as a box that you could kind of kick it into the corner that you don't see it, hide it behind the sofa, you won't see it, and then you've got these little speakers. Now, the problem with that is that one subwoofer in a room is an extremely challenging thing to make work well at more than one position. And I'm sure we'll come on to these technicalities of it. Now, over the years, what we've done is we've kind of looked to see how sound can be improved. Subwoofer well integrated will definitely do that. People appreciate bass, so more good bass is pretty much always a good thing. So what we saw was that systems moved to using multiple subwoofers, and the benefit of multiple subwoofers is that they can mitigate some of the standing waves, room resonances is the term I use, that you find in a room at low frequencies, which are all related to the dimensions of the room and where people are within the space. Now, lots of studies and lots of very cool stuff that's gone into that. What you will typically find is that two subwoofers works pretty okay for a sofa. If you've got rows of seats, or you're just wanting a bit more, four subwoofers, for the longest time was kind of an optimal number. Now, of course, there was a fairly rapid change, and it's one of those ones that I find very interesting. So four subwoofers work brilliantly well, and I have all the data to show me how well four subwoofers can be integrated into a system. But all of a sudden, I'm sure people on the forums are going, "Oh, but so and so has like literally 18 subwoofers in his room, and eight at the front and 10 at the back, and all of this type of stuff." Well, what brought that about was actually Trinov's waveforming technology, and waveforming really made it more simple to integrate more subwoofers. Now, there are lots of interesting bits of maths about that and all those types of things. Of course, there are. It's probably an interesting debate. What's the benefit of going from 4 to 18 or 12 or whatever else? It's not like it's a small jump that you go through when you move up into these things. And it's something that I have to say I personally struggle with because I know how well four subwoofers can work. I could go mad, I could put five in and I could do a super low bass subwoofer. But that's what you're starting to see now. And we're even starting to see bass managed sub bass systems, which seems utterly crazy to me. But again, that's something that you're starting to see where you have people will be familiar now, I think. Infra bass is this new topic that suddenly seemed to appear. That's the very, very low end. Let's try and define that as the space below the lowest room resonance would be the infra bass region, and then crossed over and then kick bass and all of those types of things as you move up through the range. It's all very, very interesting. To see all of those types of things. But for me personally, I would caution, if you can get two subwoofers, you can still do a tremendous job. Four subwoofers in the right hands will always do pretty much as good a job as these crazy things. So you don't need to think about building your theatre in subwoofers these days. But that's kind of where we're almost approaching. Especially in the US, you'll see a lot of these things with just unbelievable quantities of subwoofers in them.
And of course, I don't want to get cliched here, but because we mention this on every discussion we have about audio, but the room is important. And of course, if you're talking about that many subwoofers, we're talking about quite a big space to fill. And this is the next point that we're coming on to, which is basically, how do we make a subwoofer work optimally? And the first thing we need to think about, obviously there, Neil and Ed, is the space in which you're going to use that speaker and what you want it to do in terms of playback.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, Neil can do his complicated one. From my perspective, ultimately, we haven't got more than two speakers, non-sub bass transducers to concern ourselves with. I mean, I'm aware and have experienced. I mean, obviously, at the Bristol show recently, we had a 2.6 system in a technical sense of the word. I mean, obviously, the three subs were on each side were essentially arranged on axis. They weren't being instructed to do significantly different things. They weren't being told to do the same thing. Unless you've got some really interesting requirements and a very large room indeed, from my perspective, 2.2 is about as far as you are really going to want to take two-channel audio for all but the most sort of specialist requirements. And essentially, because there are only two speakers in the room, you are looking at the mechanics of the relationship of however many subwoofers you choose, be it one, two, or more to those two speakers. It's not the same in as Neil is creating a sound field and is having many, many channels of information to do that. I've got two, and I simply want to augment those two. So, broadly speaking, with some provisos, staying on axis and look and doing your best to essentially identify the relationship between a channel and its attendant subwoofer is going to get you quite a long way in two channel, but for multi-channel, I suspect it's a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, it's an interesting point, Sid. So one of the things that we've got to consider is when you talk about sub bass, and all sound basically is a sound wave. And bass has just got such long wavelengths. I don't think people can imagine how long the wavelengths of bass notes are. You're talking 20, 30 meters long waves, some of these things. Now, those waves are so long that clearly they are massively longer than the rooms that we are in. And you can have all sorts of debates about timings and all of those types of stuff, but you are effectively in the sound at those low frequencies because the waves are so long. Now, what that means is that in the sub bass region, in terms of consistency, the room almost dominates everything. It's really a spatial relationship between the speaker, the listener, and the room dimensions that dominates everything when it comes to sub bass. Now, where that gets very interesting, of course, and where in fact at cinema and two channel, if we can say that, perhaps diverge. At the risk of pulling stereotypes, two channel is often a little bit of a more solo experience compared to home cinema.
Yes, no argument there. We
Yep.
very rarely have rows of seating for your two-channel hi-fi seating.
Exactly. And that's really where the big sort of difference comes when you're trying to do a bass system for a cinema. The consistency across the entire listening area is one of the most critical factors because it's really true that you can have a middle seat that sounds great, and if you're not careful, the literal next seat can have a huge suck out right through the main bass region. That happens all the time. In a 2.4 meter high room, which guess what is a lot of them, that the height axis often has a suck out around 80 hertz. Wow, that's really annoying for people who know how to do these things. That's something that happens all the time. Whereas what Ed was saying in a two channel system, often the cohesion between the handoff from the main speaker to the subwoofer, it can be more interesting to focus on the sort of location, what's the word I'm looking for there, the consistency between those things across your whole sound stage, as opposed to trying to there is a point, unless you've got very large speakers, that you've got like a transition zone. You go from the main speaker to the subwoofer and then your localization. You've always got to be careful not to have a spread just in that low upper bass, let's call it, region. So that's where you kind of get those differences between the setup between a cinema and a two channel system. Ultimately, it's the same goal. It's to get good kick and cohesion, but a little bit different approach normally.
So it's all about your room. I say this every time, and the kit that you're using and your end goal. Now let's focus on hi-fi, and then we'll get to millions of subwoofers in a cinema and the difficulties there, because that's where the difficulties really are. So I think the guys have explained it really quite well here. So I guess the first point that we're going to say to people in terms of using a subwoofer for two channel, you can get away with using one
Yes.
subwoofer. In a two-channel system, depending on the size of the room. But if we take an average living room size in the UK, you can generally get away with that. The main thing you need to be concentrating on, as Neil says, is your crossover point, and making sure that is, you can close your eyes and you can't localize where the bass is coming from. It's probably the
You
best
need to be
way.
careful with your setup on one. It's actually ironically can be more difficult to set one up really
Yeah.
well than two.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you can get away with it, absolutely.
Yeah. And where things can help, and I've had this problem in the room that I'm in at the minute, is I only have room for one subwoofer really, in a couple of locations, but only one subwoofer really in the way that this room is being used. The biggest help was actually Derac. Or even Odyssey can do a pretty good job of handling the crossover point, and that handoff, because this is where measurements and taking those measurements and applying a filter will do a lot of good. As long as you've done the basics right, which we've covered in the last conversation we had on EQ, as long as you've got a fairly good starting point, it's fairly easy for the software then to put that filter in place and so on. Like Neil says, it's difficult with one subwoofer, but if you manage to get it well positioned and use a little bit of EQ, usually you can't tell you've got a subwoofer in the room. You think you've got full range speakers, and that's what you're aiming for at the end of the day, isn't it, Ed? Because what you don't want is this juxtaposition or this handoff between your great speakers on your stands and then the bass suddenly coming in
Well, we weren't
and
having a
joins
discussion about full range speakers versus crossovers. Don't get
Well,
yourself on a different tangent here.
that's all fun and games in itself. And then just to add an extra layer of faff to this, in a two channel sense, a lot of the crossover points that we're talking about are between, let's say, for the sake of argument, 49 and 31 hertz. Generally speaking, if your speakers go lower than that, you probably aren't going to be looking at a sub. And higher than that, the chances are that there's different solutions going on anyway. In a number of UK rooms, my own listening room included, that is also at a point where a room node is kicking in as well. So you've got the business of handing over seamlessly at exactly the same point where the frequency responses of both objects are being artificially augmented. This means if you're doing it in a purely analog sense, you have bought a subwoofer with a manual crossover on the back of it, and you are essentially looking at your speaker's measured frequency response. If you just do it on, well, it says it goes down to that, bosh, so on and so forth. The chances are, unfortunately, fate is going to just vomit on your eiderdown because the chances are the room has got some strong sayings on that. If you look at most of the speaker reviews I've done over the last, certainly since I moved into this house, almost every single speaker I've tested has bettered its in room, its claimed in room response, because my room very gently, it must be said quite benignly, just gives it that little goose at the bottom. So we've had this conversation come up before. If you really want to make a decent go of this, even if you are not using a Dirac or system where it's got subwoofer management in the amplifier itself, for goodness sake, measure the room, please. Whatever you might get cross about spending a little bit of outlay on doing that measurement, you will more than save it at whatever hourly rate you think you're paid. Because essentially, the on-paper measurement of where you think you're crossing over will almost certainly be incorrect because the room will be enhancing that point. So once you've done that, if you can measure the room, requirements for two-channel subs and multi-channel subs, there's a subtle difference in so much as best as I understand it, when I dip into the multi-channel reviews, subwoofers these days can be essentially headless. The processor slash AV receiver or similar is going to do almost every single form of instruction they are. They just need to be a socking great amplifier, a socking great driver in the most robust cabinet you can get together. Two-channel subwoofers can also follow that path. If you are a Dirac user or Trinov user, not Trinov, Lingdorf, so on and so forth, where there's excellent bass management on board, the subwoofer doesn't need to have much or anything in the way of adjustment itself. It can be electronically allocated. In a more trad two-channel system, adjustment is very, very useful. Crossover and volume. I'm tempted to say that a phase control, which is not a simple phase switch, but is a fully variable 0 to 180 degree phase control, will help you. But again, setting phase by ear is a dark art. Again, it's something that you would want to measure if you are having phase issues. You can minimize phase issues. As Neil says, the bass frequency is always going to be longer, but you can at least get a bit of a head start on phase adjustment by having the speaker on axis with the subwoofer in roughly the same place and where it needs to be. It's not going to be perfect, but it's going to help you begin. So you look at some of the subwoofers that we've seen on the site and we see elsewhere, they're either extremely clever and they've got lots of EQ functionality of their own, or they are stripped back bare minimal. Companies that produce things that are more two-channel oriented, and the two that really stand out for me on this is REL of British hi-fi fame and Eclipse, the Japanese manufacturer, who build some very specialist subwoofers to partner their single driver subwoofers, a single driver loudspeakers, I should say. Those have got some very, very, they've got some useful bells and whistles in terms of integrating in a world free from DSP. If you do have DSP and Dirac, you can essentially, the world is your oyster. You will get almost anything to behave itself. Just don't, standard rules, don't buy something which is going to overload your room. But if you're looking for something where you are going to be doing all the adjustments on the back of the subwoofer, make sure that you have the means of doing those adjustments.
Now, you probably just scared quite a few people, Ed, by mentioning measurement and so on. It's one of these things that people suddenly think, well, that's too much time, and I need to learn something new, and so on. But actually, and I'll come to Neil because Neil measures things on a very regular basis and could probably tell you off the top of his head if you give him room dimensions where issues will be. It's not that difficult, is it, Neil? You just need to get your head around a few things and spend. You don't spend a lot of money because REW software is free, which you can get online, nice and easy. I'm going to do some show and tell. A mini DSP mic like this. I think I paid £90 for this. Neil's probably got one as well. It's the what's the name of it again? It is the Neil's going to correct me on this one. It hasn't got the name on it, but you'll find that anywhere online. And £90, it's well worth spending the
That's how
money.
you make one.
That's the one.
That's how you make one.
Yeah. And it's industry standard now. Everybody uses that thing. And like I say, dead easy to get one. The software is free. Take a couple of evenings, read the forums. There's lots of great threads on the forums explaining that. And that hopefully gets you over that hurdle. And then, Neil, the world's really your oyster because once you can measure using your kit and your speakers and your location and your room, then you can start to build up a picture of how to integrate your subwoofer and get the best possible performance.
Well, you actually said something before that. So one of the tools that is woefully underutilized is a model up front. Now, bass problems in rooms are pretty much linked to how big the room is in each dimension. So you can do that modeling. My own website, Cinema Tools, has that. Room EQ Wizard has an excellent modeling tool where you can you put in the room dimensions and you can set the speaker and listener locations, and it will model the expected response for that. And that's actually probably that's where I would start with. If people download the Room EQ Wizard, just to do the modeling part of things, because it's uncannily accurate, I have to tell you, at those low frequencies. Now, then when you get on to the measurement part of things, people tend to freak out with the Room EQ Wizard about how complicated the interface looks like and all of that type of stuff. But there's no getting around it. It's not the ultimate in ultra user friendliness, mainly because of what it's trying to do, as opposed to the amazing design work that John Mulcahy did over all these years of giving us these amazing tools to use for free. It is worth learning how to do it because the combination of the model And the combination of being able to do a few little things, like Ed was talking about phase there. Phase used to be horrible. 2 degrees measure, 2 degrees measure, 2 degrees measure. You'd be there for months. Was painful. And the Rumiku Wizard now, you can do two measurements, put in a beautiful thing that says match phase at cursor, and it does all of its amazing maths for you. You just do it. It has been transformative because it has been updated so much over the years. I cannot say enough if people would donate to the Rumiku Wizard, because any competing software is going to be £2,000 or £3,000. Compared to that, it's the most unbelievable bargain in audio, that gets given away for free.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, so that's the approach if you want to go that far, or you, like we said earlier, just make sure the room is it is nicely put together as much as possible, and then use some EQ. There's plenty of great EQ out there that all works as well, when it comes to bass. We have also mentioned trends, so there are some trends that really are changing the way that we look at subwoofers and so on. And you mentioned what Trinov are doing, Neil, and there are some other examples or recommendations out there. So in the professional world, where are things at the minute?
Well, actually, it's really interesting. So, if you look at the really professional world in studios, every studio is getting converted at this minute in time to being a 714 Atmos studio, which are very interesting to me how they still do it with 0.1. And there's lots of very interesting and weird to me white papers about how people try to optimize with one subwoofer and are amazed to find that room issues dominate. I've seen quite a few of those types of papers lately, and it's like, I mean, this is not new stuff, guys. This has been going on for a long time, this whole issue of sub bass, So, ironically, a lot of guys are doing in their homes are way, way, way ahead of what the professional studios are doing. I think there's one thing in trends, though, that before we dive too far into that, one thing that we've not spoken about yet is there are really three types of subwoofers. Okay. You've got sealed subwoofers, ported subwoofers, and then subwoofers with a passive radiator. Okay. Now, it used to be that you would take a ported subwoofer. Now, the benefit of a ported subwoofer is it's very easy in relative terms to drive that to the port tuning frequency. But then the performance just falls off like a stone at the port tuning frequency. But now you're starting to see a lot more interest in, do I combine a sealed subwoofer? So a sealed subwoofer, in some ways is more difficult to drive. The cabinet pressure needs to be overcome by power, basically. But the group delay, the timing is much better from a sealed subwoofer compared to a ported subwoofer. It's just physics and how they work. So it used to be that you would say, okay, if I take a sealed sub, I'll get that hertz, and it will sound amazing, but is that enough? And that's typically where this whole discussion about ported subwoofers would come from. Well, in our world, we have all of these insane sealed 21-inch subs and all that type of stuff these days, with impulse responses like you can't even imagine. I saw one at ISE that was made of pure carbon fiber, and it truly astonished me how light that cone was. And it was 21 inches in diameter. That thing, it just blew my mind. Put 3,000 watts into it and it'll eat it up all day long, that'll make your inside shake. Now, then you've got the funny one in the middle with the passive radiator. So passive radiator is when you've got a sub and it looks like it's got like one or two extra drivers on it, and basically they're in between ported and sealed. The movement of those things on the side makes it easier for the actual main driver to drive. They all have slightly different behavior, so it's probably not the forum to go into that. For me, if you're looking at a two-channel system, a really nice sealed subwoofer is going to be hard to beat from a timing perspective.
100%.
Come with it.
And it's interesting, even when you deal with notionally hi-fi optimized things with radiators on. Just you can measure what the radiator's doing, and depending on which direction the radiator is pointing in, especially if we're, I mean, you know, let's face it, you can have an argument for hours over the threshold of omnidirectionality, but if the radiator is operating at points above that of omnidirectionality, you just end up with some strange behavior. And it's not necessarily something that I would fall over myself to get involved in. I mean, something oddly I've always found worked relatively well in a two channel sense was counter firing active drivers. So one on either side of the cabinet, in a benign room where it was centrally placed between the two stereo loudspeakers. The end result there, even though the actual bass drivers were not pointing in the same direction as the drivers themselves, with a little bit of care in phase, that ended up doing some quite impressive things. But weirdly, that is a configuration that I think has become less popular in the
Well, that's
last
your
10 years.
symmetric drive woofer. And
Yeah.
there is one company that people will have heard of that really are good at that, and that's Sonos, because that's how Sonos subwoofers all work, with a symmetric drive woofer. And
Yeah.
Fine Audio also do a lot of that stuff still.
It's still something that I rate very highly. For certainly for a 2.1 setup, it you know, so long as you do have a degree of free placement in where the subwoofer will go, I've had some good results with that. So it's, you know, if the options are there, it's something to consider.
I think that one, because you're exactly right, you get a cancellation, a mechanical cancellation, these two big things wobbling, they counterbalance each other.
Yeah.
The reason I think that that's fallen a little bit out of favor is nothing to do with its technical merit. It's a physical challenge, because almost by definition, you've got to have the drivers on the side. So the thing is the depth of the drivers
Yes.
diameter, as opposed to however your voice coil is. And
Yeah.
that's the honestly that's the biggest challenge of that. There is some cool new technology that we've seen recently, subwoofers that have got a single voice coil driving two independent
Oh,
drivers
okay.
do that, which is quite interesting. So I've seen some
But
cool
you
stuff.
remember the old Boas PV1, you know, the ball. I
yeah
mean,
yeah
that was always, I mean, you sort of discard it as a sort of lifestyle trinket, but it was actually very capable
sure
if you used it with any degree of mechanical sympathy, which most people didn't. So yeah, things like that, you know, I was always quite impressed with items along those lines, and it's good to know that actually there is at least still some development in that potential, because I think it can be made to work extremely well.
Well, I think it does, but that whole thing, because it's all about your area, so it had a big advantage in area and all that type of stuff as well. So now what you see is that area moves to these big massive drivers that
Yeah.
we're talking about. So what changed a lot for the design capabilities that we can do? It used to be you really had to use a ported to get the low frequency extension, but now we have access to such large drivers that can take so much power. We can actually do sealed subwoofers that genuinely play to 25 hertz. Now, the advantage of that is if you look at an anechoic measurement of a subwoofer that plays to 25 hertz, when you put that in a room, that's below the lowest resonant frequency, and it all gets
Yeah.
very mathy here. With a sealed subwoofer compared to a ported subwoofer, because of the way room gain works, that actually all of a sudden your room gain balances out the roll off. So you get a very, very flat response way deep down, much lower than the sealed subwoofer's spec
Yeah.
would make you think, and retaining all that quickness and everything. So what we are really trying to do is use big sealed subwoofers, and drive them as hard as we can to get that quick response as far down into the frequency range as possible these days.
Yeah.
Got to have a big room to fit
Well, I
all
mean, you know, this is
the
unfortunately money talks in so many different ways, isn't it?
toys,
But
though.
yes.
So, right, let's get it back to the real basic thing, because we could really deep dive into this, and that's not really the point. The point of this is to try and give the best advice we can to people who are maybe introducing subwoofer for the first time, a two-channel system, or they want to get more out of the home theater system, home cinema system, and so on. So, Ed, first of all, What's your advice to people out there? They've got a nice two-channel system at the minute, but they feel like they're just missing that little bit of kick at the bottom end, or they just want to fill in the sound a little bit. What's your advice to them? What route are you going to put them on?
First of all, when they say they're missing that last bit of low end, they need to be honest with themselves. How low is that low end that they're missing? Because, like so many aspects of messing with physics, if let's say you've got a small pair of stand mount speakers and you've got minimal energy below 50 hertz, that's not a particularly complicated thing to augment in a nice, organized way. If you've got a socking great pair of floor standers and you feel that those are still not delivering the sort of spleen loosening effect that you really, really want. So let's say that for the sake of argument, you're going down 20 hertz lower on a pair of loudspeakers and you want to fill in that space below that. It's a substantially more complicated and expensive process to fill that in. So it's worth being, if you feel that your floor standers in room are not delivering significant bass, is sufficient bass. Just have a think about how much you want to spend to sort that, because it's going to do, to just add more noise isn't that expensive. To add decent high quality fill in below 30 hertz is an expensive business. 50 hertz, that's something where you could look at a single subwoofer. I agree with Neil that if you can, a single sealed box design, ideally with a driver in it, would be a way to start looking. And there's plenty of manufacturers that turn out those items. If again, you can then to add to this, that's you don't mind it potentially being visible and on axis with your loudspeakers. If you can follow the instructions about measuring the room and checking where you would hand over the crossover, it would be a case of buying one of those, making sure that you have an output on your amplifier, either a pre-out dedicated subwoofer out. Generally speaking, on most stereo amplifiers, there isn't actually a difference. They don't have any particular management. It's just whether they've got one or two of them. Or if you're feeling really, really trad, you can look at various high-level speaker outputs, which some manufacturers get very excited about. I've never been particularly bowled over by the differences that result from that. And then it's a question of spending a careful afternoon or two just getting it dialed in. If you wanted to add something that went from 49 hertz to, I don't know, 25, £1,000 as a rule of thumb, £1,000 would probably sort you a solution that could do that pretty damn well. And if you really wanted to make a go of it, if you then started looking at devices like the Bluesound Node Icon that we've recently tested, or even the WIM products with their own, tweakable EQ, you can then use measurements to then just make a better job of dialing that subwoofer in. If you're looking for something to fill in below 30 hertz to, I don't know, threshold of your audibility, think of a number and make it larger. And then also make sure the room is pretty large to start with, because the box in question, Neil's talking about 20 inch drivers. Yeah. I mean, serious, clean, non-distortion, low end energy requires a substantial amount of horsepower and scale to achieve. And depending on what music you listen to, I genuinely would recommend going to listen to an implemented system before you decide whether it's worth the effort. If you're an organ music fan, and I'm not being derogatory here, there are plenty of organ music fans, it becomes something that's worth doing, because something that actually replicates something which fills churches, to actually get that visceral sense is worth the effort. If you're listening to something which moves a bit faster than organ music, then it starts getting a bit complicated. You may find you've got clean extra extension, but just transient speed. We're incredibly sensitive to transient speed, and things that move like the clappers that are very large tend to be very expensive. And you may find that the loss of transient speed more than outweighs any gain that you get in your perceived bass response. So once you start looking at spending a lot of money, same with so many things, go to a dealer that knows what they're talking about and get a bloody good listen, because you may find even the well implemented solution is not for you. But if you're filling in a pair of stand mount loudspeakers, there's no reason why it need be astronomically expensive, and the end result should be quite satisfying to listen to.
Well, the other argument there, or not an argument, but the other solution there, Ed, sometimes, and certainly I know quite a few people who have gone down this road, enthusiasts, hi-fi enthusiasts and so on, they've gone and gotten the floor standing speakers that they've always pined after
Yes.
and so on, and hated the sound in their space because they couldn't give their speaker enough room to breathe and do what it needed to do in that
Yes.
space to get that kind of response. And they reverted back to stand mounts, high quality stand mounts, but then with some sub bass
Yes,
implementation
that's,
underneath
I mean,
that.
often that is, I've tested speakers in this room for AV Forms and other sites where I have been pushing the physical limitations of the room. And thankfully I have enough understanding of the room and enough understanding of a few other things to be able to listen through that. But yeah, the idea of spending 10, £12,000 and essentially having a gently hobbled performance is not desperately appealing. I mean, it's an expensive solution to say to someone, if you want more bass, move house. But I mean, depending on how far you want to push this, it's not necessarily an unreasonable one. So yes, and then the last, I suppose there's one last non-subwoofer based wild card on this. If you are, I mean, this applies to so many things. If you really are up against it with LFE and things like that, don't forget that if we switch to the world of the very small, a pair of very well sorted, good quality, open backed dynamic driver headphones, most of those are ruler flat to 20 hertz, and some of them are ruler flat to quite a long way below 20 hertz. So if the listening experience is extremely lonely and it's just you, and you really want bass and good, clean, really top-notch bass, the headphone people have been smiling to themselves and enjoying this for decades, because essentially you change the rules of physics because you change the listening space and the listening distances, and those people are experiencing a linearity of low-end response that most of us in room can only dream of.
Excellent. That's a great summary, Ed. Thank you very much for that wrap up on the hi-fi. So, Neil, home theatre. Now, let's just say that somebody's got a reasonable budget, a realistic budget. We're talking about, a lot of forum members out there. They want to improve the bass performance of their home cinema. It is an often asked question. People do have issues with it. What's your advice to them?
Well, I think that when you're starting to look at a room above, sound bars and stuff like that, where someone has gone out and they've bought a pretty nice set of speakers, 7.x.4, that's someone who's already made quite a big commitment. They've probably got a nice processor or an AVR. They're into that for maybe five figures already, a room like that. Now, I think that to really expand on a room like that, it's not something that you're going to do for, a couple of thousand pounds. You've got to be thinking 3,000-4,000 pounds to give the shove that you're looking for as a minimum. But that's mainly because I'm talking about doing it with at least two subwoofers, ideally four subwoofers in a space like that. Really because of the difference, as we said, it's all about spatial. However, anyone who's spending that sort of money would be well set to get some really good advice and support in the setup of that thing. If they're upgrading an existing theatre, hopefully they've maybe worked with someone before or on the forums, they're going to get advice on where those things can be laid out. If it's a new build theatre, I mean, that's just a matter of course that those things should be designed properly to work in those situations. The reason of that cost, it's not really down to beautiful cabinet finishes and all of those types of things. If you're going to take a box and you're going to make that play to, 100 plus decibels at 20 hertz, it's actually very, very, very difficult, I can tell you. Even if you accept 25 hertz, you will save yourself quite a bit of money. You need powerful amplification. You're going to have some DSP. There's just a lot goes into it to deliver that next level, if you like. So, it's not something to be undertaken too lightly. If you're in the hobby, it's probably one of the most interesting bits of the hobby, though, to get into.
Excellent. Well, there you go. Hopefully we've answered some questions there and pointed you in the right direction. Of course, Head over to the forums. There's lots and lots of experience over on the forums. Lots of people building systems, probably like the ones that you're thinking about. So head over there, see what other people are doing. And again, just think about the basics as we always do. And I know it sounds cliched every time we see it, but get the basics right, and then everything else should follow after that. And it should be a bit simpler, whether you're putting together two channel or a home theater. You'll notice that I've separated these camps out because I think an interesting discussion is for another day, and that is, can hi-fi be home theater and home theater be hi-fi using subwoofers? Is it, it does it, that is like a whole new conversation which we're not going to go into today. That's it for today. But if you haven't got any questions, then do put them in the comments section. We do read them, we do take them on board, and if you're asking us questions and so on that we can then answer in future podcasts, we will absolutely do that. So please do put your comments there, whether that's on YouTube or on AV forums in the podcast forum underneath this podcast, then please do that. So my thanks to Neil Davidson and of course Ed Selly. Join us in another video. Please like and subscribe, and we'll see you again soon. Goodbye.